All right, we'll pick up the class on session 17, page 136 of your notebook. Let's do a little bit of review before we get into page 136. We're nearing the end of the third major section of your notebook, End of Exile, 1839 to 1947, the Modern Zionist Movement. Now, last week, we took a little digression and looked at The Miracle of Survival, Hitler and the Holocaust, on the DVD Against All Odds, Israel Survives. So it was a quick introduction to the Holocaust for those of you that were not familiar with it. Then we saw that Churchill had been voted out of office, and Prime Minister Clement Attlee was now at the helm of the British Empire. He was not exactly positive toward forming a new nation called Israel. Even less positive was his foreign secretary, Ernest Bevin, very anti-Israel. He had taken a 180-degree turn. 15 years prior, he had supported the formation of the Jewish state. Now, because of his desire to keep the Arab countries happy, he was totally against the modern state of Israel. So was the U.S. State Department at that time, yes. Yes, the Balfour Declaration was well before him, but the British government was fairly positive toward the modern state until World War I and World War II. All right, our State Department was also anti-Zionism, anti-Israel at that time. For example, Under Secretary of State Joseph Grew said the biggest obstacle to a good relation with the Arabs would be Zionism in our country during this time. So he was an anti-Zionist. So was President Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was a bit equivocal on the topic. He informed Ibn Saud that he wouldn't do anything without consulting both Arabs and Jews, and basically his remark was, due to the situation in the Middle East, nothing can be done for the Zionists, for the DPs, for the Jewish people. And remember what advisor, I forget the guy's name now. Excuse me, Niles, yes. What Niles said, he said he doubted if the modern state of Israel would have come into existence, and here's the amazing statement, if Roosevelt had lived. Now, that doesn't come from some Bible crazy, does it? We do know that the God raises up kings and brings them down. And so right at a crucial, crucial time for the survival of the state of Israel, the biggest impediment is suddenly removed. Is that just coincidence? And guess who comes to the presidency following him? Good old Harry Truman. Now, Harry Truman's a Democrat. You would think that Harry Truman would think the same way as Roosevelt thought. But Harry Truman was 180 degrees away from Roosevelt. Harry Truman was a staunch Zionist and very much a supporter of the DPs and the DP camps. So the Lord brought in his person into the presidency at just the right moment, just when it was needed. And of course, there was a tremendous controversy going on about the DPs, whether they should be allowed into Palestine or not. And so the Haganah, the Zionists, began Aliyah Beit, Immigration Plan B. In other words, illegal immigration, but far more extensive than anything that had done before. It was to be an immigration activity that would be in the tens of thousands of Jewish people getting into Palestine. At that same time, the British, because of Truman's very positive stance toward the DPs, they were kind of incensed at him for taking that position, suggested that a committee be formed to look into the problem. So the Anglo-American Committee was formed, and hearings were held discussing the DP problem in Europe, the displaced persons problem in Europe. And this is Ben-Gurion. Testifying at the Anglo-American Committee. The Anglo-American Committee produced this document, 100 pages, a survey of Palestine, in which they unanimously recommended that the 100,000 DPs be allowed into Palestine immediately. Immediately. Truman immediately endorsed that recommendation But the British were incensed by it. They suggested the Anglo-American Committee, and then they rejected the recommendations. And Truman's statement approving the movement of 100,000 DPs into Palestine through, remember what I shared with you last week, threw Bevin into the one of the blackest rages he'd ever been in. And my heart bleeds for Bevin over that. Pity poor Mr. Bevin. Okay, that brings us to page 136 in your outline. And we start with probably the most famous terrorist attack by Jewish terrorists. Yes, we do have our terrorists. We do have our share, unfortunately. And this is when the Etzel, the Irgun, blows up the King David Hotel. Okay, everybody there? All righty. July 26, 1946, a group of armed Etzel members entered the kitchen of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. An entire wing of the building was occupied by government offices together with the headquarters of the CID, the Criminal Investigation Division. The saboteurs deposited heavy milk cans packed with gelgonite, that's a form of dynamite, gelgonite in the hotel's lower quarters. Time fuses were set, the men departed. Now, according to Menachem Begin, according to Begin's later account, remember he was leading the Etzel at this time, a warning of the impending explosion was telephoned to the CID. The British subsequently denied that any warning was received. When the explosion went off in the hotel, 25 minutes later, 91 Britishers, Arabs, and Jews were killed. 45 were injured. And you can see a picture of the damage on page 136. Here is a picture of the King David Hotel in 1931, a luxury hotel in Jerusalem. And then, of course, somebody was stationed to pick up the blast as it occurred. Somebody was anticipating it. Here's a picture of the blast as it went off. And another picture of the rubble taken shortly after, just like Oklahoma City, yeah. And here is, again, a picture of the cleanup of the King David Hotel. So it must have been a gruesome thing to do to try to dig 91 bodies out of that rubble. And this is the King David Hotel today, rebuilt and still a luxury hotel in Jerusalem. When you guys have gone to Jerusalem with me, we did not stay in the King David Hotel. A little too expensive. Now, I've just walked through it. That's all I've done is admired it. But it's quite a hotel. All right, so it's functioning. That's where all the heads of state stay when they come to Israel. All righty. Back to our notebook. The Jewish agency was no less horrified than the British government by the King David bombing. Ben-Gurion, who never brought himself to totally disavow earlier underground raids on British installations, now furiously condemned the Etzel, the Irgun, and urged Palestine Jewry to turn its members in whenever they were discovered. On a later occasion, the Haganah managed to foil an Etzel scheme to blow up the British police headquarters in Tel Aviv. But Menachem Begin and his men were not easily deterred. Rather, they intensified their attacks on military transport, destroying vehicles, paralyzing railroad traffic, and occasionally killing British personnel. Now, let's turn to the DP scene. Early in 1946, the British intensified their blockade against illegal immigration. With nearly 8,000 displaced persons sailing from Italian ports by then, interception was almost certain, usually just inside Palestine territorial waters. The refugees were forcibly transferred to British vessels and then carried off to Cyprus. So I want to give you a geographical fix here. So here's the Middle East, and this is the island of Cyprus, controlled by the British at this time. So let's jump off our satellite and get a little closer here, a little closer. And a little closer. Now we're going to take a look at this particular peninsula in Cyprus. And so here we are, and now you can see the location of the two DP camps in Cyprus. One to the northern, on the northern side of that peninsula, one on the southern side of that peninsula. Two major DP camps. All righty. So that's where the refugees were transported by the British. Now, to discourage immigration, the internment camps on Cyprus were made as forbidding as possible. The heat in the summer was infernal. Water was always short. Food barely adequate. And here's some pictures of the DP camps. Here is a picture of the water distribution to the internees. So limited water distribution, enough for everybody, but just enough. And here's a picture of the winter camp. It's called the winter camp because it's made up of Quonset huts, metal Quonset huts, which I'm sure were ovens in the summer. The summer camp was tents. So here you can see the winter camp. And this is a Rosh Hashanah card, a New Year's card, a Jewish New Year's card, drawn by somebody, guess where? Not in Jerusalem, not in Tel Aviv, not in Tiberias, but from a DP camp on Cyprus. Lashana Tova Tikatevu. Happy New Year, basically. Huh? In the Jewish year 5708, yes. Which is 1948, I believe. So this came from one of the Jewish refugees in the camp. All righty. So the camps were not very hospitable. But even so, the flow of illegals continued with growing momentum. To the Jewish survivors, Cyprus was merely another stepping stone to Palestine. And not infrequently, the DPs resisted British boarding parties, and deaths occurred on both sides. All but five of 63 refugee ships were intercepted between 1945 and 1948, with the internment of 26,000 DPs on Cyprus. There were 100,000 DPs in European displaced person camps. 26% of them ended up in the Cyprus camps. At 26%, one quarter. Yet this was precisely the message of the refugee tragedy that the Zionists were determined to convey. Its impact on world opinion and the British taxpayer turned out to be the Jews' most effective weapon. So now we go to top of page 137 and UN scope, 1947. In 1947, the United Nations was chosen as the instrument to cope with the issue of Palestine. The Britain turned the fate of Palestine over to this world body April 2, 1947. The British were very tired of governing the area through the mandate. Subsequently, an 11-nation investigative board, have we heard of this before? An 11-nation investigative board was set up on May 13th and was entitled the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, UN scope. So we have another special committee over and over again. It never stops, does it? This is number 5, I believe. Now, the committee was a balanced group, but troubles were brewing from the very beginning. Britain insisted that it would neither abandon the mandate nor enforce the decision unless the solution were just and acceptable to both Arabs and Jews. So this is a rather improbable expectation, as we've seen from the past number of years. Upon learning that UN scope included the plight of the refugees in their thinking, the Arab states warned that they too would not necessarily be bound by the United Nations recommendation. You know, we may not cooperate with the world body that we have joined, you know. And, you know, this is what irritates me about the United Nothing. You know, even today, if the United Nothing comes up with a recommendation and a country doesn't like it, they don't follow through. They don't do anything with it, you know. So it's just a big debating society is all it is. All right, I'm going to stop preaching here. UN scope group arrived in the Holy Land mid-June 1947. The Arab Higher Committee decided to what? Guess what? They decided to boycott the UN SCOP hearings. Again, nothing new. That's the pattern that's been established. Now, that decision was probably a tactical blunder. Although the United Nations group managed to interview Arabs unofficially during its 5 weeks in Palestine and sample their views, this informal poll hardly compared to the elaborate and documented testimony offered by the Zionists. In addition, the strident, aggressive statements of the Arabs convinced the UN scope members that it would be fatal to leave the Jews as a minority in Arab hands. And you guys, 66 years later, has anything changed? Example, from the times of Israel. I check this newspaper every day. This is an article about the 31st Congress, the Union of Islamic Organizations, in Paris, just last month, a few days ago, April 23rd, 2014. The comments are by Hani Ramadan, a prominent Muslim leader from Geneva. According to the news site www.europe-israel.org, Ramadan said this during his address: "All the evil in the world originates from the Jews and the Zionist barbarism. All the evil in the world is the Jews' fault." I'm sorry, you guys, I apologize. Didn't mean to do that to you all. And he finished up by saying, "Against these international schemes of Zionist power, there's only one rampart, Islam. So the Jews control the world, and the only way we're going to free the world from the Jews is Islam." So, has anything changed? Comments are still strident and aggressive. The comments have not changed for 66 years. All right, Exodus 1947 on page 137. We now come to the story of the ship that launched a nation. The ship that launched a nation. One of the more important events during this time. Well, the UN scope group was in Israel. These guys are in Israel, and they're going to witness this. In mid-July, a battered little American Chesapeake Bay ferry, packed with 4,500 DPs, set out from the front porch of Sète. Six, count them, six, one, two, three, four, five, six destroyers. Six British destroyers and one cruiser waded offshore to meet this dangerous battleship that was threatening British interests. They immediately escorted the refugee ship. I can just see six destroyers all around this thing with the cruiser taking up the rear, all their guns aimed at it, you know. I exaggerate. They immediately escorted the refugee ship, appropriately named Exodus 1947, across the Mediterranean. And here it is, you guys. Here is that dangerous vessel. By the way, did you know that smokestack was really a missile launcher? It really wasn't a smokestack. And there's rockets hidden under the fairings there. So there it is. So there's the little Chesapeake Bay ferry, the Exodus 47. So 12 miles outside of Palestine territorial waters, the British Armada, I like that term, closed in on the Exodus for boarding. And a furious hand-to-hand struggle ensued. The DPs fought off the boarding party for several hours. Eventually, get this, eventually the British put machine guns and gas bombs into action, killing three and wounding 100. Machine guns and gas bombs against 4,500 men, women, and children, civilians. And six destroyers and a cruiser. I can't believe it. All the while, a detailed account of the battle was radioed to Haganah headquarters in Tel Aviv, and later rebroadcast through the world. Now, next sentence. You can mark this one. The crew of the Exodus surrendered only when the British began ramming the vessel, threatening to sink it. You want to sink a boat with 4,500 Jewish men, women, and children on board? That's a little bit of British chivalry there, isn't it? I can't believe it. Well, you'll see the damage to the boat in just a minute. Enlisting badly, the ferry was then towed into Haifa Harbor. And you have this picture on page 138 of the Exodus 47. You can see the sign there, Haganah ship Exodus 1947, and Hebrew writing on the bow. So there it is in Haifa Harbor. Now here's another picture of it taken a little later, and you notice the Haganah sign is gone. And the Hebrew has been painted over. And I assume those are refugees being taken off the ship. Now, here's a picture of some of the wounded being taken. This young man is being helped to medical care by a British soldier. And you can see the damage to the Exodus 47 there in the background. And then this man, not quite as fortunate as the young man there. So that's the story of the Exodus 19:47. Now, under ordinary circumstances, the British would have transshipped the boat's passengers to Cyprus. But in the previous 12 months, there were some 26,000 DPs, 26,000 Jewish people packed into the island in the DP camps, hopelessly overcrowding the two internment camps. So in this case, Bevin personally decided to make an example of the refugees by sending them back to their port of origin. Shortly afterward, on British transports that were essentially prison ships, the DPs were carried off to Marseille, France. There, they refused to disembark. The French government offered the refugees hospitality, medical care. The offer was rejected. The passengers insisted that their destination was the land of Israel, not France. After 3 weeks, the French government, concerned with the possibility of epidemic, ordered the vessels to depart. So at this point, the British cabinet held an emergency meeting. What are we going to do? And they decided that the only alternative was to ship the DPs back to Germany. How ironic, huh? So most of the refugees thereupon were returned to Hamburg. And some 1,500 of them, about a quarter of them, refused to disembark. And they were carried off by British troops wielding clubs and hoses. Eventually, they were transported by rail to German internment camps. From one camp to a DP camp, back to a DP camp.
Back to Auschwitz.
After a month, the British attempted to register them. But the only response they got to all their questions was, Eretz Yisrael. What's your name? Eretz Yisrael. How old are you? Eretz Yisrael. Is this your wife? Eretz Yisrael. Do you want some food? Eretz Yisrael. Anyway, a lot of guts there. Eretz, land of Israel.
Land
of Israel, yes. Land of Israel. Eretz Yisrael. That's how you say the land of Israel. So the Exodus tragedy, prolonged over 3 months, was extensively reported in newspapers throughout the world. And the UN scope members were not unaffected by the episode. They witnessed it. The representative from Yugoslavia stated of the Exodus episode, "It is the best possible evidence we can have." So the Exodus 47 affair dramatized the fact that the Jewish people need and desire a national home. And, as some of you are aware, this became the basis for the 1960 movie and book. The movie was published in 1960, starring Paul Newman, called Exodus. And it is a historical fiction movie. If you want to get it on Amazon, remember it is historical fiction. The characters are fictitious. The basic history is correct. The characters are fictitious. And then here's another movie poster as well from my generation. I graduated from high school in 1965, so I guess I was just getting into high school when this thing came out. Also, in 1958, Leon Uris wrote the book that, again, prompted the movie. So if you buy the book on Amazon, remember it is an historical fiction. Okay, get that straight now. There's a lot of fiction floating around that's people take as fact these days. All right. Okay, at this point in time, I want to show you guys another video. I want to show you video number 5 from the DVD Against All Odds, Israel Survives. And program 5 is entitled The Boy Named Ezra, because it deals with the story of a young man, and you'll meet him. He was just a teenager at this time. So his story is dramatized in Program 5, and he was part of the resistance against British rule that was going on, the attacking of British armaments, police stations, and all that kind of thing. He was part of this, and this is his story. So I'm going to let you take your break, listen for the shofar. It's 5 minutes early, so it'll be 5 minutes to 5 minutes to 8. Be sure and be back, and we'll show you this 30-minute video. So go ahead and take your break. All right, let's pick it up on page 139. UN General Assembly decides on the partition of Israel. So we pick it up with the UN scope report again. The UNSCOPE report was finished on August 31, 1947, and in it, UNSCOPE laid down 11 guiding principles. The most important stated that the mandate should be ended and independence granted at the earliest possible date, earliest practical date. UNSCOPE divided 7-3 into a majority recommending partition, of course that's into two states, and the minority proposing federation, that is maintaining one state. In favoring partition, the majority scheme envisioned an Arab area comprising Western Galilee and the hill country of central Palestine, except for the Jerusalem enclave, and a coastal plain as far south as a line from Ashdod to the Egyptian border. The Jewish territory would include the rest, except for the Jerusalem-Bethlehem area, which would be internationalized. Now, you have this map on page 139, but up on the screen you can see the two nations that were envisioned, the blue area being the Jewish state, so you see that it is eastern Galilee, then the seacoast from Haifa down to Tel Aviv Joppa, and then the Negev, basically, the Negev Desert to the south. And the Arab state would be the western Galilee at the top, then the central highlands, we call Judea and Samaria today, and then the from the Gaza Strip down along the Egyptian border. So that was the proposed partition of the area into two nations. Now, the Jewish immigration would continue. It would continue at a rate of 6,250 people a month for the first 2 years for a total of 150,000, and thereafter at the rate of 5,000 monthly or 60,000 per year. Now, there was little in the majority report to set the Zionists dancing in the streets. Territorially, it envisioned for both peoples, and by the way, this is a mark-it-up sentence here, mark-it-up moment. You should underline this. This quote is fantastic. Territorially, it envisioned for both peoples asymmetrical segments that were that were entwined in an antagonistic embrace like two fighting serpents. What a prophetic description! That was Herbert Samuel's description of the earlier Peel plan, but it's no less true now. Two nations entwined in an antagonistic embrace like two fighting serpents. However, it offered two indispensable prerequisites. Number one, national sovereignty, a nation. And number two, an uninterrupted flow of immigration for the foreseeable future. All right, we're on page 140. Now, the Jewish agency therefore expressed cautious satisfaction with the majority report. The Arabs, conversely, guess what? Rejected it with a passion. Same pattern, SOP, Standard Operating Procedure. The Arab League formally threatened war if the United Nations approved the UNSCOPE report. Now, on November 25, 1947, the Palestine Commission approved an amended partition plan, 25-13, the Arab state would embrace 4,500 square miles. 804,000 population would be Arab. That's 98.5%. And 10,000 would be Jewish people, 1.5%. The Jewish state would encompass 5,500 square miles, a little larger, but most of that, of course, is the Negev, the desert. 538,000 people would be Jewish. That's 59%. 397,000 would be Arabs, 41%. So the Arab state was definitely biased toward Arab population. The Jewish state would be more equal in population, 60% Jewish, 40% Arab. In November 29th, the partition resolution was submitted to the full session of the General Assembly for the desired vote. The General Assembly resolution was approved by a vote of 33-13, giving it the necessary two-thirds majority. So then the British mandate was scheduled to end on May 14, 1948. And the Jewish reaction, here's a picture of the Jewish reaction, joy, after seeing our homeland in the process of being restored after an absence of 2,000 years. But there was a different reaction from the Arab states. The Arab reaction was the beginning of Arab attacks on page 140. And that's all we have time for tonight. We'll pick it up next week with the beginning of Arab attacks against the partition resolution when we come back next week. So let me go ahead and close in prayer, and then I'll turn you guys loose with actually, a couple of minutes to spare. That's a switch, isn't it? How did that happen? I agree. Let you out early. All righty, let's pray. Father, again, we want to thank you for overseeing this class, and thank you for the work you've done in the nation of Israel, the little miracles, such as with Ezra, and keeping him safe in response to the fervent prayer of his mother, to the bigger miracle of bringing the proper governments into place so that the state of Israel could be formed. Lord, we look to you and we say this is your work. This could not be done with human effort alone. This is too impossible and too unique a story. And in the same way, our lives are all unique. And we know that just as you worked uniquely in the lives of people in the state of Israel and in the forming of Israel, so you work uniquely in our lives as well. You know every hair on our head. Help us to remember that, especially when times are tough, but also when times are good. Help us never to forget you and your care for us, even if we maybe don't understand exactly where things are going. Help us to remember that you're in charge, just as you were in charge of the formation of the state of Israel. So we do thank you. Help us to remember that, and we ask you to help us in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.